You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of workers are getting ready for in-person work again, but is there a way to create better workplaces than we had before the pandemic? We'll hear from an expert on burnout. Now, former Green Bay Packers Hall of Famer Brett Favre is out with a new public service campaign taking on tackle football for young kids. The ad warned about the effects of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a brain disease caused by repeated head trauma that's also known as CTE. Here's a listen to that public service announcement.
I could be fighting depression, struggling to keep my thoughts straight. I could become violent, even towards my own children. When I'm your age, what will matter to me is not my youth football career, but that, like you, I'm a great parent and I can provide for my family.
So please, keep me out of tackle football until I'm 14.
We're talking about what we know about the risk of brain injuries in youth sports, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever struggled over whether to let your kid play contact sports like tackle football? Has your kid gotten a concussion during sports? If so, how did it impact them? Do you think that tackle football should be off the table under age 14? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Stamm is a clinical assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology. She's author of the new book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and the Future. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we dig into some of the science about youth sports and its impact on the brain, what is your reaction to this public service campaign? We heard Brett Favre there saying, hey, no tackle football until 14.
I think it's a great idea for a number of reasons. The brain is developing so much, especially in that, you know, 8 to 12 range through age 14, and delaying tackling gives the brain more time to develop and also reduces the risk of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, as he said in that campaign. So it's not about, you know, not playing football. It's just about not tackling until we get to an older age where the body is better prepared to handle the tackle and the brain has developed more.
And before we get more into the downsides, you make a really strong point in your book talking about your own career in sports and just the value of getting more kids involved in sports of some sort. Can you talk about how beneficial that can be?
Absolutely. Sports are so beneficial for kids. There are so many health benefits, both on the physical health side and developing physical activity habits that last through a lifetime, and also on the mental health side and the social side. Team sports in particular provide great benefits. You have that team camaraderie, you have mentorship from older players, from coaches, and you learn so many life lessons in sports, things like leadership, dedication, grit, that's so important for working through all sorts of things in life. So there's so many benefits to sports, and it always scares me a bit that this research will discourage parents from letting kids play sports. And it's not about whether to play or not. It's about what type of sport do we play and how do we play sports like football and hockey and soccer, but in a way that can protect that developing brain.
Now let's talk about the risks, especially in these contact sports, of repeated impacts and blows and jars related to the head, especially for that youth. What do we know about the hazards?
Yeah, so for a long time, we used to think that if somebody was hit in the head and they didn't have any symptoms of a concussion, that those hits didn't really matter. And now we know that those hits actually have consequences, especially the more that you experience. So more and more hits to the head repeatedly over a season and a career can change the brain. There's research that has shown in individuals who had no concussion over the season, there were differences in the brain from preseason to postseason in just high school players and in youth players as well. So we're now learning that those hits matter. And we also know that the more hits you sustain, the greater the risk for chronic traumatic encephalopathy later in life. So both changes somewhat immediately or over the course of a season, and also changes happening later in life leading to a disease can happen just from these repetitive impacts, regardless of whether or not a person sustains a concussion.
You mentioned in your book a common response to the idea of banning tackling in youth football. One that you've heard on the sidelines yourself is, hey, these kids are smaller than pro athletes. They're slower. So you put those together, these impacts aren't so bad. They aren't so damaging. What do you say to that?
Yeah, and that seems like a very logical argument, but the data actually shows that's not really true. So on the number of hits, kids can hit their head hundreds of times in just a short youth season. Those youth seasons tend to be about half the length of a high school season. So in about half the time, they're still hitting their heads 200, 300, 400 or even more times in just that youth season. And when it comes to the force, they do look smaller and they don't look like they hit very hard. But a child's head is disproportionately large compared to their body. And then you put a football helmet on that, and it's like a bobblehead effect. So hits actually transmit a very similar force to the brain for youth players as that of the high school players and the college players. So they really are hitting that hard, or at least that's what their brain is experiencing.
Talking to Julie Stamm from UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology, author of the new book, The Brain on Youth Sports, looking at calls, including from Brett Favre, for no tackling in youth football under the age of 14. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Sam is with us in Menominee Falls. Sam, hi.
Hi. I played tackle football from 4th grade to 11th grade, and I was very good at it. But I received several hard hits throughout my career, and it was discovered in my junior year of high school that the cumulative effect of all those hits had a increased effect on me and made me cut my career short. I was experiencing memory difficulties and mood swings, and it was as a result from the brain damage. And it's taken me, I'm still working on some of the effects 15 years later.
Wow.
Although they are more manageable now with medication, but it is a very real issue. And I will also say that just because we are smaller doesn't mean that those hits don't hurt.
And Sam, I want to ask before we let you go, and I'm sorry to hear the story, your story. I'm glad you're recovering, but if you had it to do over again, do you wish you had never played at all, or do you wish you had started later and then played?
I wish I had started later because I was already looking at a couple of scholarship options. And I feel like if I had started later and not taken as many hits when I was younger and didn't know enough, my body wasn't prepared enough to take those hits, I feel like I could have had a longer career.
Sam, thank you so much for sharing your story. Julie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think what Sam said is so true, that if you wait, you're going to experience fewer hits. Your body in general isn't going to experience those impacts that can affect not just your brain, but you know, other injuries to other parts of the body. And now with some of the changes that have happened at the high school level to reduce contact practice time, you know, if coaches really take that seriously and really limit those impacts in practice, the odds of having a longer career are even better, right? That great players aren't going to be cutting their career short because of those you know, repetitive impacts and then the results of that. So I think, you know, that's a great point, that starting later can actually potentially prolong your career.
Sam, thanks again for calling. We're talking to Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology, author of the new book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and the Future. We're talking about the risks of head injury for kids in some contact sports, how to prevent those. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you handle these issues in your family, especially if you had a kid who was excited about playing a contact sport? What was the conversation like? Are you confused by what you're hearing out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about tackle football for kids and the risk of concussion in that and other sports after Brett Favre joined a public service campaign saying no tackling till age 14. Julie Stamm stays with us from UW-Madison, author of the new book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and the Future. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julie, we've been focusing mostly on football here. That's not the only contact sport you write about. Are there changes you think need to happen in things like the soccers and rugbies of the world?
Absolutely. Soccer has taken some steps at the youth level. So soccer has banned heading before age 11 and limited that until age 13. Hockey is another one that has taken bigger strides to really eliminate those repetitive impacts at young ages. So they have banned checking before age 13 in hockey, both in the USA and Canada. And those sports are doing well. Hockey has more enrollment than they've had in years. So they're doing really well after that. But rugby definitely is another sport that is growing in the U.S. and really could make bigger strides to reduce those impacts. They do have some alternative types of rugby, like a flag or touch version of rugby, but they could really go farther to really say, let's wait until we're, you know, in at least middle school, if not high school, before we start tackling.
You also write that a lot of kids, if they're playing a sport, they're going to do what the pros do, what they see them doing on TV. What would you like to see from professional sports leagues and from the sports media when it comes to messages about how to behave and how to avoid head injury?
Yeah, the leagues really need to emphasize that, you know, these hard hits, the helmet to helmet hits, are not acceptable. You know, we still see that happening in the game today, and we still see that as something glorified sometimes in with the media. And it really gets down to those kids, and those kids see that, and they want to, as you said, imitate the pros. So emphasizing that those hits are not acceptable, and, you know, the media has come a long way, right? We don't have those big highlight reels of the biggest hits of the week anymore. But sometimes it still comes out, and sometimes, you know, we still hear announcers say, oh, he's toughing through that hit, or toughing through when, you know, he took a big blow to the head. And so that kind of messaging is really important, that, you know, the brain is important. We need to recognize concussions. We need to report concussions, and we need to try to prevent those repetitive impacts, especially at the young age.
Yeah, a lot of what we're talking about here is the repetitive impact. But how about how we're treating, especially in youth sports, the moment where there is a potential concussion, and making sure that, you know, the player isn't just toughing it out to not let down their team and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's really tough with kids, because kids oftentimes don't know how to articulate what they're feeling, or they may not realize that what they're feeling is a concussion. So it's really important for both parents and coaches to get to know, you know, for coaches to get to know their athletes, and for parents to just keep an eye out for, you know, your child not really acting like themselves. And there are some symptoms that can be commonly overlooked, like difficulty sleeping, or your child being more emotional than usual. That can be a sign of a concussion. So it's really important to recognize that. And if there's any doubt whatsoever, sit them out and have them checked out by a physician who has some experience managing concussions and diagnosing concussions. Better to be safe and miss a practice or one game and get checked out than to have any longer consequences from that.
Let's go back to our callers now. Zach is with us in Appleton. Zach, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, to her point, almost exactly, my brother suffered a few concussions, I think three in high school, and issues followed thereafter that went missed by standard doctors and physicians. I think a lot of times they're looking for, you know, maybe you're anxious or you have depression. A lot of parents don't bring forward the information that a concussion occurred. So just looking to maybe bring some awareness around protocols for when concussions do occur and how we can bring those forward to the forefront to the physicians and doctors that they do see.
Zach, thanks a lot for the call. I have kids who have done youth sports for a lot of years. Julie, I see at least the paperwork awareness of concussion that Zach is talking about. Is it a reality, though? Is it really being taken seriously in youth sports?
I think we have a long way to go. I think that there's more awareness around it today than there was 10 years ago, for sure. But I do think we have a long way to go. Just giving a parent a piece of paper and saying, read this and sign it, that's not effective concussion education. And that's not effective for athletes either. Also for coaches, you know, we need more interactive education and more discussion. Coaches really can go a long way in talking to their athletes during practice and saying, okay, you know, we're going to take a timeout and we're going to talk about what if you had a concussion right now and what would you do right now to help let us know that you have a concussion or that you're feeling not like yourself. So things like that can go a long way, but we really do need more education. And as the caller said too, you know, physicians, primary care physicians, ER docs, they're wonderful and they have so much that they need to know well beyond the scope of concussions, but there's so much to know on this topic too. And I think it can be very helpful to seek out care, you know, especially if it's something that's lingering, to seek care from someone who has experience and has up-to-date training on concussions, because you know, there are some really subtle symptoms that can be missed. So that training is important for everyone involved.
Zach, thanks for that call. In our last half a minute, Julie, somebody of the sports stature of Brett Favre speaking out on this, do you think that makes a difference?
I think it does. I think it can make a big difference. You know, he's somebody who was a really tough player when he played, and to hear somebody who played through everything come out and say, you know, I wish I wouldn't have done that, and you know, we really should be protecting the brain and you know, waiting to tackle, I think that can make a big difference, and I hope it does.
Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That was Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Kinesiology. She's the author of the new book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. Imagine not having a down payment or credit needed to buy a house, but still being able to get one. Around the country, experimental programs are becoming increasingly popular for would-be homeowners who can't qualify for a loan. Corrine Hess reports on a Milwaukee man's effort to make this happen.
There's a worn bungalow next to an empty lot on an otherwise crowded street here in Milwaukee's central city. This house, with its peeling gray paint, has been vacant for about a decade. Its windows are broken. The roof is completely shot. But on this hot August day, the house is bursting with activity. Reginald Reed says when his crew is finished with the rehab, a family will move in, paying on a rent-to-own basis, and they'll eventually own this house.
Every transaction doesn't require people to make money. And I think that's something that America probably needs to understand if we're going to really fix problems like homelessness and starvation and all, you know, underserved communities having no opportunities.
All across the country, there are hundreds of thousands of people paying more in rent than they would for a mortgage. That's in part because they're low income or their credit score is keeping them from qualifying to buy a house. What Reed's program is doing is essentially cutting out the bank or mortgage company. After a 13-year career in contracting, he launched an employment agency that focuses on skilled trades. The agency's trainees renovate the homes, and they're given the chance to buy them, paying 60% of the market value of the house on a rent-to-own basis. Reed's working in a part of Milwaukee where incarceration rates are some of the highest in the nation. He grew up here.
This is the place where we technically don't make it. And so not only are we making it, we're thriving. We're creating opportunities for other people to make it, and we're doing it in a way where no one can stop us.
Reginald Reed works with the city of Milwaukee to buy blighted, city-owned homes that are affordable, but often require tens of thousands of dollars of repairs just to make them inhabitable. He has ambitious plans. He wants to build or rehab 11 homes on this block. Kirk Wagner is a master carpenter who worked on large construction projects in Milwaukee, including building Fiserv Forum, where the Milwaukee Bucks play. He now works with Reginald Reed to help train and oversee those learning the skills they need to rehab houses.
You got the satisfaction, you know, of knowing that you're doing something, not just filling my boss's pockets.
While this project is innovative, it's one of many rent-to-own rehab programs across the country. A California-based startup wants to help renters build credit until they can buy a place. The group is raising $165 million from investors that includes Jay-Z's Roc Nation and Will Smith's Dreamers VC. Logan Modishami studies the housing market at HousingWire, an industry trade publication. He says these innovative programs need significantly more investment. And cutting out banks or mortgage programs is tricky, in part because the U.S. government backs mortgage loans through programs like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
There's room to grow there because there's obviously a group of Americans that have just the kind of lower level income stream that just doesn't have the kind of buying power that other Americans have.
Reginald Reed says he plans to rehab or build 100 homes in Milwaukee's Central City. And the waiting list of would-be homeowners is a long one. He and others across the country say they'll continue to work on ways to help people who can't get traditional home loans become homeowners. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, a psychologist who's an expert on workplace burnout joins the show to talk about ways to have a more balanced and healthy work life, maybe some lessons learned during the pandemic, and what to watch out for if you're going from working at home to working in person again. You can join with your experiences. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, the president has promised thousands of Afghans a new life in the United States. He says he would have done more earlier, but the former Afghan government feared that such plans might have triggered an exodus. Those with friends and family still trapped in Kabul say that's not true. Jen White gets the latest today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, a lot of people who worked at home are getting ready for in-person work again. That also means some of the stresses of pre-pandemic work could come back, too. Is there a way to avoid that? Our next guest has lots of advice on ways to spot and prevent burnout, and she's got ideas for how to make the post-pandemic workplace a better, healthier environment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're getting ready to go back to work in person, are you worried about burnout? Have things been better or worse working from home all or part-time? If you've been at the workplace all along, did things get harder during the pandemic for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jacinta Jimenez is a psychologist, executive coach, and author. Her book is called The Burnout Fix, Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. Jacinta, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
For those people who have been working at home all the time or most of the time, maybe getting ready to come back, what is on your mind for them in the world of burnout?
Yeah, this is a really big transition for a lot of folks. You know, there's people in both camps who enjoyed working from home, others who are dying to go back to the office. But in either case, you know, throughout the pandemic, we really found our homes as a place of safety. And so to switch out of going from our house to the work environment can bring forth a lot of change. And so it's really important that we proactively think about how we're going to manage this transition and acknowledge the change that is happening, because we're coming back to a new world of work in a lot of ways. Things have changed since the pandemic.
How can we be proactive about that? What kind of things can we think about? Can we prepare to go back into work?
Yeah. First, I recommend begin mentally preparing yourself for the return to work by walking through scenarios you might encounter at work to help you feel more at ease. In psychology, we call this prospection. And what we've learned through science is that imagery is very powerful in helping folks adaptively respond to potentially anxiety-filled situations. So when you engage in this practice, it helps you gear up emotionally. I also recommend just paying attention to your body because the mind and body are so connected. You know, for example, focusing on your sleep schedule. You know, having to commute and get back to work at a specific time may be a shock to your body's schedule. And so it can be beneficial to work on establishing a routine, bedtime and wake time for returning to work. Plus, you know, the benefits of sleep are tremendous. It can buffer you emotionally and physically against stress that may come with this transition. But I think the most important thing I would recommend for folks is practicing self-compassion with yourself or others. It's okay to feel anxious about returning. It's a big transition. So be kind to yourself during the process. You know, the research shows self-compassion can go a really long way in providing you with greater resilience, stronger motivation, and just increase mental well-being overall.
And of course, there's a big category of people who never started working from home. They do jobs at grocery store work or a restaurant work or a lot of other things where you have to do the job on the site. There's the added worry. Am I going to get sick? Am I going to get my family sick? A lot of reports of customers being more rude or hostile over mask mandates or whatever. What have you been watching for in the world of burnout for those people who never went home and worked from home?
Oh, yes. You know, those folks who have been on the front lines doing work really have tapped into what we call a surge capacity, which we are wired with. Humans, we are so resilient. And we don't want to use this all the time, but when faced with crisis, we get this second wind almost, or we get this surge capacity. But that lasts about 6 months. And so I could imagine a lot of folks, and this is what we're seeing, are feeling really exhausted. And the important thing is to start making sure to proactively manage that stress with rest. And I don't mean like big vacations or changes. You know, we all can't do that. It's more about small micro doses of stress, replenishment and rest throughout the entire day. So 5 minutes, 10 minutes here and there to make sure your nervous system isn't activated for a prolonged period of time. Burnout happens when we have prolonged stress that is not successfully managed. So being able to be proactive and giving your body, especially your nervous system, chances to rest and recover is going to be essential to keep working in an environment where there is a lot of anxiety and ambiguity and complexity and all the other things that come along with working in a pandemic.
And just see, I left one group out of that list on person with a special asterisk, healthcare workers. Not only have they been in person all along, they've been really in the thick of things. For a lot of them, it's coming back now. How do we even start to make sure they're not burned out?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Healthcare workers. I mean, talk about the setup for compassion fatigue where you know, there's a saying I really like. It's like, you can't walk through water so long without getting wet. And when you are in it, in the trenches, day to day out, that can really wreak havoc on someone's vitality and well-being. And so I think it's very, very important for leaders in healthcare settings to really think about fostering conditions to protect healthcare workers from burnout. And, you know, I recommend really three big pillars. I call them the ABCs of resilient organizations, but basically fostering agency or autonomy, giving people workload and resources and time constraints that are realistic and feasible and allowing them to have moments of replenishment. I think the other one is B, is benevolence, is just commit to equitable practices, act with integrity, and recognize what your people are doing. And then the third one is community. We are so resilient as human species for so long because we existed in tribes. And so it's so important to bolster inclusion and belonging, foster conditions for psychological safety, where the healthcare worker can raise their hand and say, hey, I'm worried here. I feel like I'm going into the red in terms of my well-being. What can I do and how can you help me? If their psychological safety isn't there, not going to happen. And just caring for your employees as people. We are human beings. We are not machines. And as Michael Gungor, one of my favorite quotes is, burnout happens when you try to avoid being human for too long.
Talking to Jacinta Jimenez, author of the book, The Burnout Fix. She's a psychologist. We're talking about workplace burnout during the pandemic and what happens after. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How did your job change during the pandemic? Did burnout get worse? Did you work from home and found it was a little easier? Are there things you hope change forever as we go back to something like normal? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jacinta, we talk a lot about getting back to normal. I think you're hoping that we get back to something better than normal at workplaces. What kind of things do you think we need to change structurally at the workplace to avoid burnout?
Absolutely. I think there is a silver lining to this pandemic, and that is that a global talent trend study has found that one out of every two employees want to see a greater focus on well-being at their company. People want a greater focus on mental health and well-being. Finally, leaders are realizing that it's not just about hard work or smart work like productivity hacks. Those are important, but there's a missing piece to the puzzle, and that is about pro-resilience practices and mindsets and skills and behaviors. And so I think people are, I'm hopeful that organizations are realizing that we need to also take care of our people, as humans, because if we continue to ask people to sacrifice their well-being and their health for the sake of productivity, no one wins in the end. We have reduced performance, there's problems with innovation, there's problems with creativity, all of these things diminish. Where on the flip side, if we invest in people's health and well-being and vitality, we actually produce greater work, we're more empathic, we're more patient, we show up to our communities, our families, our customers better, and everyone benefits. And I think one of the big ways is for organizations to set up practices for psychological safety so people can voice when they are having problems and catch it before it's too late, before they're in what I call the red. The more you can monitor for burnout, the sooner you can catch symptoms and course correct while you still have the psychological reserves to do so. But we have to set up organizations to acknowledge that mental health is tied to performance. It is tied to really great business outcomes, and people just will appreciate it and deserve to have that as part of their work.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hello.
Hi. I'd like to see the option for working from home be a lot more concrete in policy. I'd like to see that option a lot more available for a bunch of other people rather than, you know, like it's been a lot more helpful for me to do that. And if people are going to be those people that have to work from home, I'd like to see companies reimburse their employees for their internet, because if they're going to be using your home internet, you should be reimbursed a bit for that. Not for the entire bill, but for some of it, for sure. Gotcha.
John, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Jacinta, do you think that we've proven that we can do a lot of things from home that maybe businesses didn't think we could?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a tremendous amount of benefit for workers who feel more productive at home, that just not having the commute, being able to feel like they can work in an environment that is more conducive to taking breaks or investing in self-care. Absolutely. I think if there's anything I've learned from, you know, thousands upon thousands of hours of working with individuals with all sorts of industries and walks of life, is that a personalized approach to figuring out what benefits people and returning to work and building resilience is absolutely essential for really setting up conditions where people thrive. So I'm a big fan of the hybrid work environment, or where people get the flexibility to choose what's going to work best for them, and setting up conditions to support them in those decisions.
Thanks a lot for that call, John. We're talking to Jacinta Jimenez, psychologist, executive coach, and expert on burnout, author of the book, The Burnout Fix. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about preventing burnout, maybe reinventing workplaces to prevent it from happening in the first place. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Have you been burnt out at work at some point in your life? Is that point right now? Are there things that have changed during the pandemic that you think maybe should stick around post-pandemic at work? What changes would help you? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about workplace burnout with Jacinta Jimenez, author of the book, The Burnout Fix, Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you feel more or less burned out at work over the course of the pandemic? How did working from home, if you did that, change for you? Are you in one of the fields where we hear that a lot of people had a tough time? Healthcare, say, or in the airline industry, or restaurants? What did you see? Did it increase your stress level? Did it drive you out of whatever your line of work was? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jacinta, I want to talk about boundaries a little bit, where work can kind of infect our home lives, whether we're doing work on our own time or thinking about work. A big deal, especially if your workplace is your home. How do we start to set up those boundaries?
Yes, I get asked this question a lot, and it's a really important thing to think about, especially with the boundary or the line between work and life not being blurry anymore for folks who are working from home, but maybe non-existent. And, you know, one of the big things I talk about is this idea of psychological detachment. So you don't just pack up and leave work from the day. You're actually mentally taking a break from work. And research has found that people who are able to psychologically detach allow their brains to actually replenish and recharge, and they return to work more productive and resilient. So it's really important to figure out ways to be able to successfully psychologically detach. One way to do this is setting up a really set ritual where you're priming your body to go, okay, I'm going through this ritual. This means work is done and completed. There's a reason why athletes have superstitions. It primes them to kind of get set up for that next thing that they're doing. So that can be very, very useful. If you don't have an end set of work, if your work's kind of ongoing and you're not able to set that up, setting up smaller boundaries. So between this time and this time, I will do this, and also I won't do this. So not just what you won't do, but also what you will do during that time. And chunking off those boundaries and really keeping solid at those can make such a huge difference in allowing you to psychologically detach. It's really important. Even though you're not doing anything tied to work, your brain is actually, your default mode network in your brain is turned on, and it's actually making connections and synthesizing, and there's a lot going on, and you need to give your brain that psychological rest and replenishment it deserves.
What would you tell someone who's thinking, you know what, I don't think my workplace is fixable. I don't think that my bosses are willing to help me manage the burnout issues. When is it time to cut your losses and start looking for a new place of work or a new line of work?
Yeah, I know. That's such a great question. What research has found is that there's actually 6-person job mismatches that lead to burnout. So it's when the nature of our work becomes out of alignment with our capacities as humans. And so it's not just work overload. So the first thing I recommend for people to do is look at these 6 mismatches and see if one of these 6 mismatches is causing the burnout, and is there anything you can do about it? If you feel like you try to approach your manager or your boss about these things, and I'll talk about these 6 things really quickly, and you still can't make progress, then that's maybe a sign that, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. And there's only so much you can do to build out your resilience. And I think it's very important, but the nature of your work also plays a big role. We are social beings, and our environment plays a role. So the 6 mismatches are, the obvious one is work overload. Job demands exceed human limits, too much time with too few resources, but there's also too little control due to micromanagement or chaotic job conditions that can lead to burnout, a lack of reward for the work we do and not being acknowledged. That can be social, intrinsic or emotional reward. Another thing that can lead to burnout is a breakdown in community. We are human beings. We are wired to connect. We've survived for centuries in tribes, and we come into this world literally connected to another person. If we don't have a positive connection with others in the workplace, or it feels like a caustic work environment, that alone can lead to burnout. Another one that is really tragic is a values conflict. So the requirements of your job conflict with your personal principles and values. And that can really take a toll on someone if they're being asked to do work that doesn't align for what they stand for. And last but not least, absence of fairness. So a lack of justice in terms of systems or procedures. And so if we're able to target which of these six mismatches is causing your burnout the most and trying to address that with your manager or within your organization, that can go a long way than just saying, oh, I burned out. I worked to the point of exhaustion, so I need to work less. It may not be overwork. It could be a values conflict. And if you're not addressing that specific cause, you may be missing the key thing that you need fixed to in order to thrive in your work.
Talking to psychologist Jacinta Jimenez, author of the book, The Burnout Fix, looking at workplace burnout, especially during the pandemic, and what might change in the workplace of the future. It's still time for you to share your burnout story or burnout recovery story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jacinta, earlier you were talking about, you know, the benefits of a company or managers or whatever taking their employees' psychological well-being seriously. But how do you, I don't know, it might be a tough mindset shift from the important thing is our sales measures this week or the number of items scanned per minute at the grocery register or whatever that measure is, getting beyond that daily count and looking to this bigger picture. How do you get people to make that mindset shift?
Yeah, I think it is literally going to require pretty substantial mindset shifts to realize that working harder and working smarter doesn't always pan out, because beyond it's what science shows us is beyond a certain threshold, our ability to be productive actually diminishes. And when we have too much stress, our performance decreases and mistakes increase. Injuries happen. Then we have absenteeism, diminished turnover, medical and legal costs, all of these things that actually hurt the company's bottom line significantly. And on the flip side, the research shows that, we can make so much gains and do better work and have better outcomes if we invest in our people's mental and physical well-being. It's fundamental to really thrive in our new world of work, which is volatile, complex, uncertain, and ambiguous, which creates a lot of can potentially, if the person's not supported with psychological resources and safety, can create a lot of churn and ultimately result in diminished productivity.
Do you think that we're going to come out of the pandemic with increasing awareness of burnout, of workplace burnout, in all its different guises?
Well, my hope is yes. And I know that sounds kind of strange, but I'm like, yes, because before the pandemic, burnout was a growing epidemic in itself. We are entering into this new world of work thanks to technology, which is changing how we operate at an unprecedented pace. But we're hanging on to outdated formulas of what it takes to be and stay successful in work. And we really need to change these mental models and rethink what works at work. And so this is an opportunity. And if there's any time to do it, the time is now. So I'm very optimistic and very hopeful that finally we're going to get to talking about burnout and really thinking about solutions at the organizational level and the individual level to help stave off this growing epidemic.
It's a good place to leave it. Jacinta, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jacinta Jimenez. She's a psychologist, executive coach, and author of the book, The Burnout Fix, Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. We've been talking about workplace burnout and how it's been affected by the pandemic and how it might change our workplaces in the years to come. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, what's old is new again in the dairy world. Find out about the latest research on foraging and pastures with a UW researcher and what it all means for dairy farmers and consumers. That's coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a Wisconsin veteran of the war in Afghanistan about the fall of Kabul and the future of that country. And by the way, we've got an ongoing conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page about the value of talking with strangers. Another conversation we had today, and we want to hear from you. Are you someone who can naturally just strike up a conversation with whoever, whenever, wherever? Or does it come a little harder to you? Do you like it when strangers strike up a conversation, maybe at the coffee shop, on the train, you name it? Let us know. Share your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.